Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, in association with Henpicked, Wisdom of Women.
Donna Leon, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you very much.
We are here talking about Earthly Remains, which is your latest, and what number?
I think it's 20, it's either 25 or 26.
Wow.
26, a voice from the back whispers
so
to me.
The 26th Commissario Brunetti novel. Introduce us specifically to Earthly Remains, and then we'll get on to Brunetti.
Okay. It is a book in which Brunetti has something of a burnout. He just can't do it anymore. I'm sure no one who has a job or an office job knows what I'm talking about. But some people get tired of their jobs. Brunetti does, and as a result of this, he goes out to one of the islands near Venice, Sant'Erasmo, where he hopes to do nothing but lie on the sofa and read. He takes five books with him, very carefully choosing them, Greek and Roman. And after he's been there a couple of days, rowing with an old friend of the family, something happens and he gets thrust back into being a cop again. He has to investigate a murder, well, a death, a suspicious death. And the novel progresses from there. But what I like about the book is that he does what I am increasingly doing, and that is escaping the city. When a person can no longer stand what I have come to call the migration of the wildebeest in every spring, he and I leave the city. He went to the Laguna, out into the Laguna, and I go to the Swiss Alps and go walking.
I had a feeling, I didn't know that you split your time in Switzerland, and I had a feeling if it was to escape the stifling crowds.
Yeah, you have to. You can't live on Oxford Street during the Christmas rush. And more, that is what Venice has become, because there's 58,000 people living there, and it's now announced that there are 33 million tourists a year. And so the numbers preclude peace and harmony on the street.
I did go to Venice for my 40th birthday, and the tourists were intense, but I did say, well, they shouldn't have made it so darn pretty.
Yeah.
And so magical.
Yeah. It remains that. And I think that most people understandably want to see it, and so they go. I'm not sure that many of them do see it because they're so busy taking selfies in front of this and in front of that. I think if you go without a camera and you actually look at it, then you see how overwhelmingly beautiful the place is.
Yeah. And life on water is different.
Life on water is different, yeah.
Yeah.
Life without cars is different. Life walking is different. And in all three cases, it's better.
Mm. I have to say, I imagine the Venetian women who were there, who, I have to say, are very adept with their buggies going up and going down.
Mm-hmm.
They must get really tired of tourists. Can I help you with that?
Yeah. Or trying to drag your shopping cart through a lot of people is very, very difficult.
Yeah.
Especially in some cases if you're 84.
I did get the feeling, though, reading the book and also from talking to you now, that a true love of Venice and a wonder
of
Venice remains.
You can't believe it's so beautiful because, and here I speak of the city before the arrival of the wildebeests. Everything that the eye fell upon was beautiful, man-made beautiful. And I think there are a few places in the world where it's all beautiful. Certainly London is a knockout, Paris is a knockout, New York is a knockout, but it's not, those three cities aren't all beautiful, but most of Venice was.
And when did you first move to Venice?
I moved in 81, but I went there first in 69, I think, and I was lucky enough to make the friendship of two Venetians who are now married, and Franco and Roberta are my oldest friends, and it's at that familial level where there are duties and responsibilities and the obligation to call home every couple of days to assure them that I have not fallen into the hands of human traffickers, that I have not fallen victim of all of the risks outside Venice, and to be at Christmas dinner or else.
Yes.
Although that's never said.
Yes.
That's just implicit in the friendship.
Yeah, the rights and obligations.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of true family.
Yeah.
Okay, and speaking of the rights and obligations of true family, because Brunetti is in this house on Sant'Orasmo. It's a family friend.
Mm-hmm.
And local people he went to high school with.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone seems to have been married or a cousin or
mm-hmm.
someone.
Mm-hmm.
There are connections and they're small places.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone knows everything.
It's true.
Yeah.
It's true. If I want to know something about someone in the city, if I ask around for an hour, if I make a couple of phone calls or I talk to people who might work in the same business, in the same profession, I can usually find someone. If I say, well, I'm a friend of Lino, Lino said that you would tell me something about, then I can find out what I would like to know about a person. Not always, but very often, because people are always willing to gossip. People love gossip. Saves my profession.
David Cassati is the person who disappears.
Mm-hmm.
And it must be, you're a terrible widowmaker. You've got a massive body count. You set up these lovely
yeah.
characters. We all fall in love with them.
And then Zach.
We love
this Zacate.
Man. Exactly.
Whack. Yeah, well.
And you yank them out from underneath.
No. Strangely enough, readers don't seem to mind that. In all of these 25 books with I don't know how many people murdered in sometimes unpleasant ways, not that there's a pleasant way to murder someone, I have received only two letters of protest about killing, my killing. And that was about Poppy, the golden retriever. I had two letters, both from England.
I was going to say, that's for English people.
I should have left the question to you. Protesting, how could I possibly kill that gorgeous dog? Children, men, women, whole families exterminated. No, it doesn't matter. Poppy.
Oh. Yeah, why did you?
See?
That's terrible. But, and through this, I think your books, correct me if I'm wrong, in saying that your purview has widened as well. That in this book you take in, you know, it's just a mention, but then it does go throughout. And I'm talking about the Aral Sea in Uzbekistan
mm-hmm.
and being leached through cotton farming.
Mm-hmm.
And that circles back to the poisoning of the lagoon.
Yeah.
And your purview seems to widen and take in these things. Has that been an evolution for you?
Yeah, that's become an evolution.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's in the second book that someone's killed because of illegal dumping of waste. And in another book, in the beginning of the series, there are jokes made about ecology. The kids bang on the door when he uses too much hot water in the shower, but it's treated as a joke. But now, after 25 years, I can't joke about the ecology anymore. It's not funny to me anymore. It is, and I think this keeps my equilibrium about current events in the United States, that onerous as they are and horrific as they are, in the face of what I perceive to be the ecological risk to the planet, they pale virtually to nothingness. And the elimination of the Aral Sea in the big scene is far worse, because that has destroyed the ecology of that entire region. And the elimination of bodies of water and the change in water levels will do far more damage than any single politician can do, unless he's the politician who appoints a climate change denier to the Environmental Protection Agency. That's the only thing
I
will be...
At which point you have the trifecta of crap.
Yes. Yeah, you have the trifecta. When he starts mucking with... If he just mucks around with internal politics or foreign affairs, I don't care. But when the thing that affects everybody... Everybody living on this planet now will be affected in some way, directly or indirectly, by ecological decisions and consequences. Then I get crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I just go into what Italians say is tilt. Tilt.
Sort of like a pinball machine.
Yeah, that's where it comes from. Yeah, tilt. So when a person loses control of themselves, no, lui è andato in tilt.
Well, because, and I think that's clear in the book, because it starts off with a scene of local political, corruption, which is sort of normal and treated as normal in the fabric, something else that's in the lagoon. And that is perhaps poisonous, but not toxic. And Brunetti as a character, there seems to be a sort of self-sabotage button that he presses every once in a while. Does it serve the purpose for you to keep him sort of a little bit as an underdog so he can do his work?
Yeah, because he is an underdog, because he's a, and I think it would function well similarly in any country. He is the person who has a sane vision of justice. It's not necessarily a legalistic vision of justice, but it's the same one with which most readers would have a certain amount of sympathy. And so when he gets overloaded, the readers understand why he's overloaded, because this passes some invisible don't go there warning. And he goes into tilt, as he does in this book. As the reader increasingly does in the book. But it's very, very slow that one comes to realize what's going on, just as it is very slow that slowly that Brunetti realizes what's going on.
Yes, the book starts in the stifling heat of summer and wildebeest season. And it is that stultifying heat which then becomes lulling and lovely out on Sant'Erasmo, and then suffocating. Tell me how he has evolved as a character since you. How did he come to you? Who was he? How has he changed? How has he evolved?
In the first book, there was a crime in which there was a suspicious death of a famous person, so they'd have to send somebody of a certain rank. A man at that rank would be this old, probably, in this range of years. He'd probably be married, because Italian men at that age are married. He'd probably have this many kids, because people... He'd be of a certain education level. He probably would have met... He might have met his sweetie in university, and in this case, the only thing that's unusual is that his wife is the child of an enormously wealthy aristocrat. So I figured in something that would allow him to have contact above. He could fight above his weight, because he has the family power behind him. All of those things were given, and then I had the good sense to make him a nice guy, someone that one would like to have dinner with and would find an interesting person to have a conversation with, because he knows about music, he knows about painting, he knows about history, he reads widely and reads well, and he's involved in family life. He has two teenage kids and a working wife and lots of relatives and friends. So the social fabric in which he is presented to the reader is real and complete, which is different from many protagonists in other crime novels, where the person is just the investigative tool who eats badly, doesn't sleep, doesn't change his underwear, doesn't dress well, isn't interested in clothing, doesn't much like women.
And or so female, you know, they're alcoholic, they can't be
also,
in a relationship, they can't...
They're misfits.
No. Yeah.
And that is meant to suggest that they have more energy to devote to their plight. Like Sir Gawain in The Green Knight. He's single too. He can go out after adventures and triumphs.
Quest.
He can quest, yeah.
He's got quest time.
Yeah, he's got quest time, yeah. He can be a quester because he's single. But Brunetti, with a happy family life and a busy family life, going to the opera, going to the theater, staying home and reading all night, still manages to be a reasonably successful investigator.
One of the tools at his disposal, though, which I think we all wish was at our disposal, is Signorina Elettra.
Yeah, well, she does all those things I don't know how to do, because she's a computer wizard. I don't even know if the things that she can do on the computer can actually be done. I suppose they can, because if they can get into the Pentagon, they can get in anywhere, I suspect. And she's very, very good.
She's attributed almost magical qualities.
Yes. Yeah. She's the white witch of these
yeah,
books.
Exactly. The guiding hand throughout. Maybe you did know, but I don't know if you knew this, that he would be such a long-lived character.
No. I just wanted to write one book. Mm. And so he was designed to stay with me for however long it took to write one book. But I made him nice enough to stay with me that number of months. And now it's turned out to be that number of years. And luckily I made those decisions in the first book, because otherwise I would have had to send him to detox time and time again over the course of these decades. Yeah, used one of his kids to take over.
Is he a companion of sorts? Like, is there part of your head where he, you know, exists, where he is?
I think there must be, but it's a hidden chamber, because I almost, other than in interviews, I almost never talk about these books. Almost, maybe with one person, and that is just to read the funny bits, because those are the things I like to write. So he's, but when I write about him, I know what he'd do. Instinctively, intuitively, I know what he would do and how he'd react. But I don't know where all of that information is. I can find it, but I don't know where it is. Mm. And I don't think about him.
And it comes as needed.
It comes as needed, yeah. I can call spirits from the vasty deep. It's what Owen Glendower says. I can call spirits from the vasty deep, and the king says yes, but will they come when you do summon them? He always comes when I do summon him, thank God.
So far so good.
Yeah, so far so good. Exactly. Talk to me after 50 books.
When I was younger, I...
Yes, well, hopefully he keeps coming. Donna Leon, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for yours.
Thank you for Brunetti.
You're welcome.
Thank you for also sharing your experience of Venice in a very real and tangible way.
You're more than welcome. It was a delight.
For more about Henpicked, go to henpicked.net. Brought to you by RadioGorgeous.com.